don't have a heart to come near me. Don't. Keep aside. Because Muawiyah will grab you tomorrow. And he will torture your whole family. Mafia style.
Listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
European News Bulletin.
Hi there, my name is Amir Taylor from British Capital. Now we kick things off as there are disappointing news about the aid intervention for the humanitarian crisis in Yemen, as Saeed Poreza reports.
A chilling warning at the end of Monday's virtual UN pledging conference, participated by more than 100 governments and donors. Of the nearly $4 billion sought by the world body, only $1.7 billion was offered. Among the countries cutting aid to the war-ravaged nation, the United Kingdom, a country that's benefited immensely from the sales of weapons to Saudi Arabia, who are using them against the Yemenis.
This is the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. And for any country to slash its aid to Yemen by 50% at this time is a really disgusting act.
By the UN's account, more than 16 billion Yemenis, about half the population, will face hunger this year. Nearly 50,000 are already starving to death in famine-like conditions.
The dying has started because the aid operation is half of what it should have been, and because the war is continuing.
It's a war that's been raging for 6 years now, a Saudi-led military campaign that's received support mainly from the US, the UK, and France. And it all began in 2015, aimed at reinstating this man, Abd Rabbu Mansour Hadi, as president after he lost the capital Sana'a and other strategic territories to the Houthi fighters. What the Saudis thought would be a quick military intervention has turned into a protracted conflict that's killed and injured tens of thousands. In 2019, a UN report said Britain, the US, and France might be complicit in war crimes in Yemen by arming and providing support to the Saudi-led coalition. All three have also provided Yemen with aid.
Britain will stand by Saudi Arabia through thick and thin because of that close economic relationship between the Saudis and the UK. So I don't expect Britain to break that relationship, and I think it's hypocritical, of course, that they are involved in this war on Yemen and at the same time are trying to morally assuage themselves by donating UK aid to that country.
By all accounts, Yemen is on the brink, and with this dramatic reduction in international aid by donor countries such as the United Kingdom, that man-made disaster is bound to take a turn for the worst. Saeed Poreza, London.
Well, Brett Yonkers, who's the editor-in-chief of Hadad Yemen News Agency, joins us from Belgium. Hi, good to have you on the bulletin. We saw there that UN Chief Antonio Guterres called this disappointing, the way in which the international community has stepped up or failed to do so. Your reaction?
It is definitely a very disappointing development, but unfortunately, I don't think that it could be considered surprising. And even if, let's say, the amount of aid that was given to Yemen, for Yemen was met, the $3.7 billion U.S. dollars that were called for by the United Nations, even then, of course, this is just barely, you know, scraping by in order to try to save these people. I think the Muhammad Ali al-Houthi, one of the main figures within the National Salvation Government of Yemen, which is called, of course, the Houthis, in a lot of media nowadays, he voiced his concern very, very well. He said, you know, the only real aid that Yemen needs is quite simple, the end of the war and the end of the blockade. All of this UN aid and the aid that is given by either the West, by Saudi Arabia, and even by well-meaning countries that are neutral in this conflict, all of this aid is the bare minimum that is necessary in order to somewhat lighten the load that Yemen is carrying, somewhat lighten the misery that Yemen has been carrying, the crimes that have been inflicted on this country ever since 2015. And the fact that even this bare minimum cannot be done by the nations of the so-called civilized world, or the so-called democratic free world of the West, and not by a big organization, of course, a world-renowned organization such as the United Nations, which is created with the express goal of preventing human rights abuses and preventing war worldwide, the fact that even this bare minimum has failed to be achieved is absolutely saddening. But unfortunately, for anyone who has really been following Yemen for years, and especially since this war started in 2015, this is not a surprising act. Yemen has always been silenced. The situation in Yemen has very often not been reported upon by mainstream media and the West especially. They have always tried to hush what was going on in this nation. And even now that it is sort of gaining traction in mainstream consciousness, there is very little being done in terms of deeds to really back off the words that are being spoken. And this is the latest shameful act in a very, very long story of suffering and abuses for Yemen, unfortunately.
Indeed, and very briefly, Brett, it's been a terrible year for Riyadh. We're just hearing this week about the U.S. intelligence and the kingdom's crown prince and the situation with Jamal Khashoggi. And then now we're hearing of the millions of Yemenis who are starving due to this Saudi-led war. In the middle here is Saudi Arabia, yet nothing seems to be happening in regards to holding them accountable for any of this.
Yeah, this is definitely what is the biggest case of hypocrisy I think we have seen in a long time. We know for a fact now, and everyone kind of knew that, but even the U.S. has admitted now that Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince, is directly responsible for the torture and brutal murder of Jamal Khashoggi. But much more than that, much more important than that, and much more destructive than that, has of course been his almost genocidal war against Yemen. And this also is something that has been reported on over and over again, that we know is going on, that we know is happening. 60 million people in direct threat of starvation, and yet at the end of the day, in the West, especially in the UK, in the US, and in France, the what carries the day in the end, what matters in the end, is the money. And the one country that is willing to give billions, of course, in funding, in oil money, let's say, to buy this modern equipment, modern war equipment from the West, is Saudi Arabia. And so far, this has always been carrying the day. This has always won in the end, the argument of money. And as long as the people in the West don't, you know, wake up and start doing something again to hold their governments accountable for this and really force them to come to terms with, you know, the will of the people, then I'm afraid this will continue.
Profit over people, as always. Thank you so very much.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we covered the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
Now we have some worrying news, or it could be worrying news for Labour Party leader Sir Keir Starmer. But before we get into that, Ahmed, social media has been going in on this Yemen story. Just bring it up to date for us, please.
Yeah, I mean, some people are calling out the hypocrisy because, okay, the UK has halved its aid budget to Yemen. So now it's 87 million when it previously pledged 164 million. But what people are calling out the hypocrisy over is that the UK is the second largest arms dealer to Saudi Arabia behind the United States. So we have this bizarre situation where the UK was providing aid in a situation in which it was partly responsible. Now, to give an analogy, that would be like there being a fire and somebody showing up with a small cup of water, but with a barrel of gasoline. Now, that is what was happening with the UK in regards to aid, while continuing to sell arms to Saudi Arabia, in contradiction to the UK's own ruling, in which it found that the arms sales to Saudi Arabia were illegal because they were used on civilian infrastructure to target schools, hospitals, funerals, and people doing everyday grocery shopping. Now, the UK has reputed that and disputed that claim and said that no, okay, Saudi Arabia does commit war crimes, but these are isolated incidents. Now, Human Rights Watch disagrees with this and says no, there's not isolated incidents, and has submitted a 172-page submission to the UK last year indicating the exact opposite. But, and time and time shows, when it comes to profit, it always trumps morality and in this case, international law. So there has been a fierce reaction online with Chris Williamson, who is the former Labour MP. He says, Gov cuts aid to Yemen, yet continues to sell arms to Saudi Arabia. That is responsible for the world's worst humanitarian catastrophe. Now, the UN has said that Yemen is the world's worst humanitarian catastrophe. Currently, there are 20 million people, two-thirds of Yemeni population, who depend on humanitarian assistance. But they wouldn't depend on humanitarian assistance if the war wasn't supported by the UK, France, and the US. And Bernadette says, condemnation for the UK's inexplicable cut to Yemen aid. UK companies profit from the war by selling the bombs. UK military trains the pilots. And then, when the Yemeni people are desperate, UK government cuts the aid. Shameful.
All right. Somebody might be using the term shameful for another situation that's been ongoing inside the Labour Party, but I won't ruin it for you. Bring us the story, Ahmed.
So Labour demands, demand Labour explain hiring of Israeli spy. So a leading human rights lawyer firm representing a British Palestinian Labour member are demanding answers for the party's hiring of former Israeli spy. And they want to know why a Israeli spy or ex-Israeli spy who was part of the infamous Unit 8200 was hired, not only hired, but hired to monitor the social media usage of Labour members, and are rightfully concerned that this could be used or handed over to Israeli regime forces and agencies. And there could be detrimental consequences for British Palestinian members of the Labour Party and potentially their family back home in Palestine. So as you can imagine, there's been a fierce reaction online. Simon says, shocking, Israeli intelligence officer employed by UK Labour to spy on members' social media accounts. Legitimate criticism of Israeli regime apartheid policies, colonisation, ethnic cleansing, racist medical rationing will become impossible. Jack Hughes raises a very important point. He says, why are they calling him a former Israeli spy? Has he had an epiphany? And I think this is an important point, because if you understand what a spy is, the point of a spy is to infiltrate potentially an organization and to work on behalf of another entity. So is he an ex-spy, or is he actually a spy still? Was he working for the Labour Party, or was he still working on behalf of the Israeli regime? These are questions that will rage on, and people will continue to ask and wonder why there hasn't been a response from Sir Keir Starmer or others within the Labour leadership about this action.
All right, that's an excellent question to leave things on, Ahmed Kabila. Thank you very much. Now, to some other news, because the Pentagon has announced $125 million in military aid for the Ukraine to help in its long-running conflict with Russia. During the White House press conference, Washington stated that the aid would include training, equipment, and advisory efforts, and, quote, to help Ukraine's forces preserve the country's territories. Russia and Ukraine relations deteriorated back in 2014 when the Black Sea Peninsula of Crimea rejoined Russia following a landslide referendum which voted in favor of the unification. The two sides then launched into a bloody conflict in eastern Ukraine, which has so far claimed some 13,000 lives. Russia has previously accused Western nations, such as the U.S., of interfering in its domestic and geopolitical pursuits. Now, opponents and supporters of the embattled Armenian Prime Minister, well, they've held rival rallies in the capital, Yerevan. Thousands of opposition supporters demanded the Prime Minister resign, while others marched to his residence in support. Nikol Pashinyan has faced demands to step down since he signed a peace deal in November that ended 6 weeks of intense fighting with Azerbaijan over the Nagorno-Karabakh enclave. As a result, Azerbaijan reclaimed control over large parts of the embattled region, with some question marks over the army's loyalty.
The army must do its job. The army cannot look back. The army cannot participate in political processes. The army must obey only the people and the political power chosen by the people. Anyone who acts outside this logic, acts against the people, acts against statehood, against the rule of law, and acts against the security of the Armenian Republic.
The uneasy truce between Azerbaijan and Armenia seems to be holding, with pleas from regional powers to maintain the peace. Now, Washington's ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Grenfell, says U.S. President Joe Biden's administration plans on engaging with Iran and repairing its past alliances.
We are looking for opportunities to encourage the Iranians to go back to compliance. And if they make that decision, we are prepared to also rejoin the JCPOA.
So 1 week after the U.S. and European signatories of the JCPOA met to discuss ways in which they could revive the historic 2018 deal. Tehran, however, has since stated that it would go back to full compliance of the deal once Washington has lifted all of its unilateral sanctions. In some other news now, Saudi Arabia's envoy to the UN says Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman is not responsible for the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, and the U.S. and Saudi Arabia should just move on. In 2018, the Washington Post columnist was hacked to death inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul whilst his fiancée waited for him outside. A recently declassified U.S. intelligence assessment concludes the Saudi Crown Prince personally approved the operation. Calls for Washington to act on the information are growing louder, but the White House has admitted it does not typically sanction countries it has diplomatic relations with, despite slapping visa restrictions on dozens associated with the murder. Richard Sedan, one of these days, you and I are going to discuss some items in social media that will leave us with a pep in our step and joy in our hearts. But today is not that day, sir. Let's begin with some disturbing news from Down Under.
Yes, and good to be with you again, Amina. This is a shocking headline for our first story. Neo-Nazi leader arrested after assaulting a black security guard at Channel 9. And I just want to reference a recent statement by the United Nations Secretary General, who said white supremacy and neo-Nazi movements are a global transnational threat requiring global solutions. With this in mind, the incident which took place in Melbourne, Australia.
An assault captured on film there, Richard.
Exactly, and the black security guard was racially abused at the same time. Thomas Sowell, the self-styled leader of the National Socialists, has now been arrested. What's interesting is actually Thomas Sowell said he, and I quote, fears no investigation, and yet the incident we just saw took place outside Channel 9 precisely because Channel 9 were about to run an investigative report on him and his movement. And I think, you know, and many people agree really and are making this observation, that incidents like these are a stark reminder that anywhere where settler colonialism took place, white supremacy is rearing its head, and increasingly it's being viewed as a very vile, virulent form of extremism. And of course, you know, we're seeing examples of this surface globally, and people are really demanding that the political class take action, and that the media and, of course, politicians really diagnose this kind of white supremacy as it should be, according to how many people see this, Amina.
Now I'd like you to go into the social media there with a few last comments when we come back.
So let's go first to Richard Edwards, who says, given that Victoria Police officers are known for using excessive force, I hope that vile neo-Nazi Thomas Sowell, when caught by police, resists arrest. Held accountable chimes in with, do you know who Thomas Sowell the Australian is? Let me tell you, he is a neo-Nazi trying to organise terror groups. As a conservative living in the USA, you should understand there is no place in society for people like this. Take care.
It's to show this man in his element. He's a literal Nazi, and I think a nasty Nazi wouldn't have been out of order for me to say. Now, we move on to another story, Richard, which has some parallels, if you don't mind me saying, but it's on the other side of the ocean. Explain.
This is an interesting one. White nationalists once again are using Christian symbols to spread hate. So there's a number of media outlets picked up on this, Amina. And what's happening is we've seen or are seeing Christian symbolism used increasingly during far-right white nationalist, white supremacist rallies and meetings, whatever you really want to call them. And actually, this was visible none more so than during the January the 6th riots, which took place in Washington, D.C. And this is a very poignant throwback, really, to, of course, the famous symbolism we're all used to seeing, which is, of course, the symbolism of the Ku Klux Klan, most notably in the United States. And I think what many people are saying, this is very dangerous, because when you have extremism ideology with people who really believe they're doing the bidding of God, this makes for a very lethal cocktail, of which we've seen the ramifications of in the past. And I think people are worried now we're essentially going to see some of these ramifications possibly in the present. So again, this is another harsh reminder. We're seeing this kind of ideology, this extremism spreading everywhere. And actually, January the 6th was a very pertinent example of that, Amina.
So how are we able to make a clear distinction as to an extreme minority fringe who are misusing and misappropriating a sacred symbol here, when, dare I say it, other religions don't escape as freely?
That's a very important point and question indeed, Amina. And I think one thing we should say here, of course, is that there are millions of Christians, millions of people of all faiths all around the world that are actually fighting against racism in all of its forms. But there's no getting away from this. This kind of symbolism has a massive presence in the US, certainly amongst, for example, the Proud Boys and also the Oath Keepers, the Three Percenters, and many other groups. And so I think, you know, we've seen this, we're probably going to see more of it. And I think many people would agree, and many people are certainly saying, it makes for the worst kind of apologism, really, regarding this kind of extremism, which we're seeing surface time and time again, Amina.
All right, let's rattle through some of that reaction.
Let's go to Jay Garner first, who says, evangelicals are the American version of the Taliban. I would not want to be in any heaven that would have them. They twist and shape God to be who they want him to be. Andy Hawkins says, white nationalists are once again using Christian symbols to spread hate. Makes complete sense. Why the surprise? We have a reaction from Andrew Netta Williams, who says the white people in power in America don't want to admit it exists. That's why they haven't been given the same attention, because they are white. And we have a reaction from Mad Dogs, who says the only hate being spread is the liberal media. and left extremist Democratic Party. I don't know any conservative that spreads hate, but I do know many liberals who do. Just a reminder, Amina, there's a plethora of reactions and different views online talking about this story.
All right, we leave it there, Richard Sudan, and we leave you here for the moment. In any case, stay safe.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
The first type of right that Imam Sajjad alayhi salam speaks about in his treatise is the right of God, the right of Allah, Haqqullah.
For humanity, a commentary on Risalatul Huquq of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio and program For Humanity. I'm Sayyid Wahid Alawi, and in this program For Humanity, we will talk about Risalatul Huquq. The book is divided into 50 rights, whereof we will touch right number 40. The right of the one who takes advice. In other words, the right of him who asks you for advice. Mustashir in Arabic. Right number 40 of the Sahifatu Sajjadiyya and the treatise on rights is, and the right of him who seeks your advice is that you should exert all efforts to advise him if you can provide him with a good opinion, and suggest to him to choose what you would have chosen if you were in his shoes. You should do so with mercy and with lenience, since lenience will eliminate fear, while rudeness will eliminate friendliness. In the small paragraph, the right number 40, Imam Sajjad alayhi salam talks about the one who seeks advice and the right of that person. What the Quran says and the narration says about seeking and giving advice, I would go thoroughly through all of those items throughout the program. And I can mention that at least 13 times in the Noble Quran, advice and giving advice and taking advice has been mentioned. I will mention some of those verses throughout the program, and I will likewise mention the ahadith in this regard throughout the program. Now, what I want to emphasize is that these verses has to do with advice among and between people, and not the advice or commandments which Allah gives in His book, the Quran, to the people. There is a difference. The advice which Allah gives are at least 27 verses plus. And we will also talk about the etiquette of advice. And here I will give you around 17 tips in the art of advice and how to advise people. For surely there is an art in this very sensitive subject. We should know the guidelines and what they are. The art of giving advice. Giving advice is a Quranic concept that is found, as previously said, at least 13 times in different places in the Noble Quran, especially where references are made to the purpose of sending the prophets and the functions of those prophets, Prophet Nuh, Saleh, Hud, Shu'aib, and so on and so forth, and may Allah's peace and blessings be upon them all. Prophet Hud, for example, said to his people, as mentioned in the Quran, "I convey to you the messages of my Lord, and I am to you a trustworthy advisor." Al-A'raf, verse 68. Moreover, giving advice could be an essential tool of genuine and faithful feedback. The Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam reminded us, "Fellow believers serve as mirrors unto one another." Giving good advice is a great gift, yet we sometimes run into trouble because of the way we offer it. Not all people are born with those skills and the ability to give advice tactfully or offer constructive criticism effectively. Most people forget that the point of giving advice is to help others to be successful and not to demean or belittle their worth or abilities. We will go for a break, and inshallah ta'ala, we join each other after the break.
Dear listeners, you're listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear brothers and sisters, to IRIB English Radio and the program for humanity. We were talking about right number 40 in the treatise of rights of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam Ali ibn al-Husayn. The right of him who asks you for advice, mustashir in Arabic. In this program, I will inshallah ta'ala go through approximately 17 tips on the art of giving advice. And as I mentioned, the ability to give advice in a positive and beneficial way is an art. If you are considering offering advice, it is useful to consider the following tips. Number one. Examine your motives. What intention do you have when you give advice to someone? Examine the nature of your relationship with the person to whom you are considering giving an advice. Ask yourself if the advice you are about to give will really help the other person. Also, make sure that you give the advice for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and not for the sake of your personal glamour. Number two, be sensitive about how to broach a subject, how to bring up a subject. Be aware of when and where you can bring issues up, and make sure that you have enough time and privacy. Number three, avoiding giving advice in the form of reprimand. We should be aware that giving advice should not be in a way that belittles the person. Giving advice is confidential and cautious, whereas reprimand is public and tactless. Number four, keep privacy. Giving advice in Islam should not involve exposing or exploring the privacy and personal weaknesses of people. It is narrated that the Prophet, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon him and his progeny, said, "For whoever pursues the shortcomings of his Muslim brother, Allah will pursue his." Number five, ask permission. Unsolicited advice is a major cause of grief among friends and family members. Thus, asking if your advice is desired shows respect for others and prevents resentment. That's all for this program, dear brothers and sisters. In the future programs, we'll continue with the tips on the right of the one who seeks advice from you. You can contact us through our email address, which is englishradio@irib.ir, and visit our site, parstoday.com. That's parstoday.com. Till next time, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon all of you.
صل يا ربي على طه الأمين رحمة أرسلته للعالمين وعلى آل النبي أجمعين فبهم نرجوك أحسن ختمنا.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The US's billionaires have amassed democracy-distorting concentration of wealth and power as millions have been thrown into poverty, says Chuck Collins, writer, in an article published under the heading, COVID-19 has exacerbated extreme levels of inequality. It's time for a billionaire wealth tax. Here's more. What should good societies do when a wealthy few reap enormous financial windfalls during a global pandemic? While millions lost their lives, livelihoods, health and wealth, the world's billionaires and super rich prospered. According to research from Americans for Tax Fairness and the Institute for Policy Studies, between March 18, 2020 and February 19, 2021, the combined wealth of U.S. billionaires increased by $1.3 trillion, a 44.6% increase in space of just 48 weeks. The concentration of wealth is staggering. There are now 661 billionaires in the U.S. with a total wealth of $4.26 trillion as of February 19, 2021, up from $2.9 trillion on March 18, 2020, nearly a year earlier. For perspective, the combined wealth of the bottom half of all U.S. households, 165 million people, is $2.4 trillion, according to the Federal Reserve. Elon Musk's wealth grew by an astounding $157 billion from $24.6 billion on March 18, 2020 to $182 billion on February 19, 2021, a nearly seven-fold increase boosted by the rapid increase in the value of Tesla stock. Jeff Bezos' wealth grew from $113 billion to $189 billion over the same period, an increase of almost 60%. Mark Zuckerberg's wealth grew from $54.7 billion to $95.7 billion, fueled by his ownership of Facebook. Dan Gilbert, chairman of Quicken Loans, saw his wealth skyrocket by 559% from $6.5 billion in March 2020 to $42.8 billion on February 19, 2021. These are democracy-distorting levels of concentrated wealth and power, and many of these billionaires control powerful companies with the ability, especially during the pandemic, to consolidate their market share and monopoly power over large sections of the U.S. and global economy. Amazon, Walmart, and Target have all benefited from having their main street competition effectively shuttered under the artificial economic conditions of the pandemic. The wealthy do not always benefit during economic adversity. In the aftermath of 2008 recession, U.S. billionaires saw their fortunes decline along with anyone else's. It wasn't until almost 4 years later, in September 2012, that the total wealth of the Forbes 400 exceeded its pre-2008 recession levels. While some increases in billionaire assets mirror the overall rise in stock markets, the largest gains reflect their ownership stakes in powerful companies that have taken the advantage of temporary monopoly and home isolation conditions created by the pandemic. Online retail, restaurant and food delivery apps, telemedicine, big pharma, and video conferencing have all reaped windfalls from the unusual pandemic economy. Of the roughly 56 new billionaires that emerged over 2020, many are associated with initial public offerings at companies like DoorDash, Airbnb, and Snowflake. These unseemly inequalities are the context for a debate over who should pay for trillion-dollar COVID recovery packages. While politicians of all persuasions have largely avoided talking about how to pay for the trillions in deficit spending over 2020, the moment has now arrived. Around the world, countries are considering wealth taxes on surging billionaire assets as one source. Argentina and Bolivia are both considering wealth taxes to help pay for economic recovery. Times of war and crisis in the U.S. have historically led to the institution of more progressive tax systems, including the conspiration of wealth to pay the bills. In 1862, the U.S. established an inheritance tax to help pay for the Civil War. Levies on inheritances and estates appeared during the Spanish-American War and First World War, finally being codified in 1916 with permanent federal income and estate taxes. In July 2020, several U.S. senators introduced the Make Billionaires Pay Acto levy on a one-time 60% pandemic wealth tax on billionaire gains over 2020. By one estimate, this would have raised $420 billion for a healthcare provision. Several states, including California and Washington State, have legislation pending to institute a wealth tax and make their state's taxes more progressive with higher rates on billionaires. Senator Elizabeth Warren is going to introduce an updated version of her wealth tax proposal. Warren's initial proposal was an annual wealth tax on households, with wealth starting at $50 million, roughly the 100,000 wealthiest households in the U.S. The 2% annual levy would increase to 6% on every dollar of net worth above $1 billion. The proposal would raise almost $4 trillion over the next 10 years. A tax that exempts 99.9% of taxpayers yet raises substantial revenue from billionaires is good politics and policy. While members of Congress might be divided over a wealth tax, polls over the past 2 years indicate wide public support for taxing the wealthy. An annual tax on wealth will require a new set of implementation rules. In the meantime, Congress can move quickly to restore progress to the U.S. tax code, a system that has seen tax rates paid by billionaires erode over the last half century. One proposal is to institute a millionaire surtax, a 10% income tax surcharge on incomes over $3 million, whether from capital or wages. This would raise $660 billion over the next decade entirely from households in the top 0.1% and move Americans closer to a fairer system that eliminates the preferential tax treatment of income from capital over income, from wages and work. None of these proposals will succeed unless the U.S. shuts down the tax loopholes, offshore tax havens and dynasty trusts that enable the very wealthy to hide their wealth at a dizzying pace. Taxing wealth to pay for COVID relief and economic recovery initiatives is only fair during a pandemic where lower income and people of color have been hit harshest. Today's massive concentration of wealth and power are disruptive to democratic institutions, social cohesion, and economic stability for all.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked.
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example.
Self purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Nasser Rafi'i. Please stay tuned. الانسان همانا انسان خلق الانسان من عجل آیه صحیحش این خلق الانسان من عجل.
In ayah 37 of Surah Al-Anbiya in the Holy Quran we read, man is a creature of haste. However, in continuation of the same ayah we read, so do not ask me to hasten. Now, one might ask, isn't here in this verse a contradiction? From one side, human is created from haste, and from the other side, humans are asked not to hasten. The main question here is, how a human who is created out of haste must not hasten in his actions? The best answer to this doubt is that Allah has created humans with haste and many attributes like anger or sexual desire, so that He uses them in the positive way. For instance, if there was no haste, no one would try to overtake others in doing good deeds or helping others with their needs. Thus, haste, like any other thing, can be used in both positive and negative ways. It is like a knife with which one can peel the fruit skin or hurt others. Or it's like a hammer in the hands of a blacksmith who beats the iron to make something out of it. The very sense of haste is exactly like this. It is necessary for humans. However, haste has its own timing, and we are not allowed to hasten in all our efforts. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Nasser Rafi'i. To find out more about this program and our other programs, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care, and goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 49 meters, 7,300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.